This is the most perfect hero of all time. The absolute pinnacle of what a hero should be in every way. Cliched to the point of transcendence, with no flaws or weaknesses whatsoever. A strong, virile man, of course. Irresistible to women, unmatched on the battlefield. He's probably from a noble or even godly bloodline, but even if he isn't, he's definitely some variety of the Chosen One. The world is his to save. He's true to his ideals and would never hurt an innocent. Heck, I bet he'd spare his enemies if given the choice. He doesn't revel in violence, but fights for those unable to fight for themselves. And, of course, his goal is to stop the evil villain. The ideal hero. Extra emphasis on the quotation marks. But what would happen to this hero if we started to strip away some of those qualities? What is he without his strength and good looks? What if, instead of the Chosen One, he was a mere commoner, or even something lower, like a criminal or an invalid? What if he was cowardly, rude, selfish? What if he accomplished his goals by any means necessary, even if it meant betraying his allies or hurting the innocent? What if he isn't motivated by any high ideals, or worse, just doesn't have any? What if he only cares about his own survival or revenge on those he feels have wronged him? And what if the person standing in the way of that goal just so happens to be the villain? What is this? What have we made? Is he still a hero? Or has he become something else? Well, actually, we do have a term for it. A complex, much-loved archetype. One you've probably heard of before. What we're looking at here is an anti-hero. Did you know that we make more than YouTube videos? It's true! Like this one about the magic of crafting living beings, or this one about angels and why artists render them in the ways that they do. You can see all of them over on our streaming platform Nebula by signing up for just $30 a year. That's just $2.50 a month! Visit go.nebula.tv/tailfoundry and use code TAILFOUNDRY. For such a well-known, well-loved archetype, the anti-hero is honestly a pretty nebulous concept. Everyone seems to understand this thing in slightly different ways. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines it as, simply, a protagonist or notable figure who is conspicuously lacking in heroic qualities. Wikipedia takes it a bit further, suggesting that an anti-hero usually comes with one or more of the so-called dark triad traits: psychopathy, narcissism, Machiavellianism. What's more, if you were to look at its companion article, The List of Fictional Antiheroes, you would be forgiven for assuming that the term antihero pretty much applies to every character ever written, including Donald Duck and at least half the Looney Tunes. I think a lot of this disconnect comes from what we understand to be, quote, heroic qualities, which of course means something different to every culture and era. You may have noticed earlier that I specified our ideal antihero as a man. That's because, for a long time, just being female would be enough to qualify a character as an antihero. In antiquity, heroic qualities tended to be less moral and more physical: strength, fortitude, bloodline, and, of course, masculinity. Classical heroes like Hercules aren't given a lot of character development. We know who they are and what they did, and that's about it. And with so little to go on in terms of quantifying the nature of heroism, it was pretty easy to fall out of it back then. Not of noble or divine lineage, not particularly strong, not the peak of masculine bravado. Well, back then, they'd have probably thought of you as an anti-hero. But that's definitely not how we think of them these days. In fact, by modern standards, the earliest example of an anti-hero really just isn't. Thersites, a Greek soldier from the Iliad, is described as hideously deformed, bow-legged, hunchbacked, head drawn out to a point with a mere tuft of hair atop it. In the story, he steps forward during a war meeting to criticize King Agamemnon for profiting from warfare, at which point our hero, Odysseus, beats him with the king's scepter until he cries, making the other soldiers laugh. Later interpretations of the character, including Shakespeare's, tend to present Thersites as a hero of sorts himself, unafraid to speak truth to power. But at the time of the Iliad's writing, that wasn't seen as a heroic quality. Back then, heroes didn't speak truth to power, they were loyal to their king. Despite how we feel about it now, back then, the good guy in this scene was Odysseus, who put the freak in his place. It was only hundreds of years later, when standing up against tyranny began to be treated as more heroic, that the anti-hero interpretation of Thersites caught on. But Thersites himself never changed. The way people interpreted him did. To this day, it's pretty rare to see a hero that isn't conventionally attractive. Even rarer to see one that's disabled. Technically, by our working definition so far, either of those things would still be enough to qualify a character as an anti-hero today. But I think very few people would identify, say, Quasimodo from the Disney adaptation of The Hunchback of Notre Dame as an anti-hero. He's a traditional hero who just happens to have a physical deformity. And that's because, somewhere along the line, moral traits became far more important than physical traits in how we define a hero. A modern-day hero is brave, loyal, selfless, chivalrous. It doesn't matter whether they're a man or a woman, child or adult, king or ragamuffin, considered pretty or not. And okay, maybe that's a lot to expect of one character. Not all characters are going to have all of these moral qualities. Sometimes they're going to be missing one, or a few, or even most of them. So does that technically make them all anti-heroes? Well, contrary to what we saw in our ideal hero at the start, in modern writing, giving your hero significant flaws and weaknesses is simply a sign of good characterization. No one wants to read about Mr. No Personality being perfect for 200 pages. Giving your hero's flaws, weaknesses, and doubts makes them feel deeper, more complex. For instance, Spider-Man isn't really possessed of the self-confidence and commanding presence traditional heroes tend to have. By classical standards, this quintessentially adolescent, awkward, humble character would be considered an anti-hero. But we don't really think of Spider-Man that way, do we? He's become one of our classic models for what a hero looks like. His flaws make him more interesting and take nothing from his heroism. Honestly, if I were to pick any of the big Golden Age heroes to be a secret anti-hero, I think Batman would come closest. Sure, he has almost as many heroic traits as the unquestionably heroic Superman. They're both strong, handsome, successful, brave, compassionate, and follow a strict moral code against killing. But Batman is also just so dark and brooding and tortured. Makes it sort of hard to reconcile him with the classical image of a morally virtuous hero, doesn't it? It doesn't, however, actually rob him of any of his heroism. He's not really an anti-hero by modern standards. He's more of a Byronic hero, a heroic archetype that became popular in Gothic fiction during the literary Romantic era. Instead of a lack of heroic qualities or moral fiber, Byronic heroes are basically just real moody. They're characterized by their stormy passion and emotional torment. Instead of a departure from heroism in the way of the anti-hero, the Byronic hero is more of an evolution on the tragic hero, think Oedipus or Macbeth. So, darkness, not the same as villainy. You can absolutely be a tortured hero, but still a hero through and through. Nevertheless, I think anti-heroes in the minds of most people are still fairly dark. And that's not surprising, given what happened to them in the 90s. It was around this time that anti-heroes really started to enter the popular conscience, and they did it in a grisly fashion. The popular anti-heroes of the time were often amoral, violent, or outright psychopathic. The Bride from Kill Bill is an assassin vicious in pursuit of revenge for the death of her baby. The Punisher delights in murdering the bad guys he's pursuing in the most brutal ways imaginable. These are edgy, violent characters who don't even feel a little bit bad about what they're doing. They aren't afraid to blow up the city. They don't care if they kick the dog. All they care about is getting what they want. So, there's that dark triad Wikipedia was telling us about. But wait a sec. Doesn't this sound a bit more like a villain than a hero? Kicking the dog, blowing up the city? That's certainly not what a hero does, right? Where do we draw the line? When do you fall so far from hero that you finally flip over into villainy? And where, between the two, does the anti-hero exist? Well, first we kind of have to get villains. So, let's go back to our hero turned anti-hero from the start. We already know that you can do all kinds of terrible things without quite becoming a villain, per our 90s anti-heroes, right? So, what traits can we give him to create a true villain? Here's where I think we start to look at not just morals and traits, but methods, motives, and goals as well. Like our anti-hero, our villain is probably motivated by purely selfish ends rather than the greater good. The methods he uses are probably similarly distasteful. Unjustified violence, torture, betraying allies and using them as cannon fodder. But the goal? That's where we really start to draw a line. Villains want something bad, obviously. But unlike our villain, even if their motivations are less than pure and their methods are downright detestable, our anti-hero ultimately wants something good. In the movie Deadpool, for instance, our protagonist wants to take down the evil scientist Ajax, not because of the horrors Ajax perpetrated during his attempts to create super soldiers, but because he wants revenge on the man who tormented him for years and ruined his life. He pursues that goal by ruthlessly interrogating and murdering Ajax's associates. Even when he's given the opportunity to continue his quest in a more lawful manner by joining the X-Men, Deadpool, in true anti-hero fashion, declines. And that, I think, is the key difference. Both villains and anti-heroes are capable of terrible things, but in the end, we as an audience know that what the villain wants is bad and what the anti-hero wants is good. No matter how dark, tortured, or morally questionable, the anti-hero is trying to achieve something that we can ultimately agree with. Although, notably, this is not the same as a villain who thinks they're doing the right thing. I know the difference seems subtle, but I think it's an important one. Think of Thanos in the Avengers series. He's convinced that he's saving the universe by killing half the beings living in it. Somehow. His logic is transparently flimsy, even from a distance. It nevertheless makes him a more interesting, more nuanced villain than one who knows and accepts that what they're doing is evil. More empathetic. Just look at the subreddit r Thanos did nothing wrong to see this in action. It's a joke, but look how resonant this character has become, just because he had what he thought was a good reason for doing what he was doing. The word for this self-deluded type of villain is not anti-hero, but anti-villain. And we probably need to do a whole separate video on those at some point too. If you really want to see that, be sure to leave a comment. So, I think we have a pretty good working boundary here. A hero, by modern standards, is someone with strong moral fiber who may be flawed, but tries to do the right thing. An anti-hero doesn't really have that moral fiber, may even exhibit the opposite, but still ultimately tries to do something good. And a villain, no matter their moral qualities or their motivation, is someone who ultimately does something bad. There you go. Easy. But there is one tiny problem here. How do we know whether what these characters are trying to do should be considered good or bad to begin with? The obvious answer is that you should use your own moral judgment, which is of course highly subjective based on where you live, the era you are born in, and so many other factors beside. But I'm going to venture to say here that that is not the right answer. You can, of course, determine what you personally think the morality of the character's goals are, but what about Thersites? If we think of him as a hero, it suddenly makes the text look very alien and unempathetic. Why would the author knowingly cast the story's true hero, Odysseus, in such a harsh light? The answer is that he wouldn't. Remember, at the time and place of this story's writing, it wasn't seen as immoral for Odysseus to treat this poor soldier in the way that he did. I think to answer this question, how do you know what's supposed to be good or bad in the story, and therefore who the heroes and the villains are, is that the story will tell you. Instead of applying your own judgment here, you can use the text itself, the context of the story, to determine the roles of its characters. You can usually tell who's who through the language used to describe them and their actions, or whether the author ultimately chooses to vindicate or punish them. You can always opine about the morality later, but the story will make a lot more sense in the moment if you listen to its implicit sense of morality first. And to that point, this is one of the things I love so much about anti-heroes, and one of the reasons I really want to make a video about them. By definition, they operate in a gray area. Who they are depends so much on what we understand about their ultimate aims. If we don't know what to think, the story doesn't tell us, the distinction between anti-hero and villain all but disappears. Sometimes their goals even change partway through as they slowly transition into villainy, and we barely even notice. But in the stories where we just can't quite tell if their motives are good or bad, everyone just kind of becomes a character. This is more common in mature works, where the intended audience is adults and the intended Aesop is none. Antiheroes leave us room to argue. They muddy the authorial intent in audience interpretation in a way that forces you to confront not just the story's morality, but your own as well. These characters want good things, but when do their methods and motivations become so reprehensible that you abhor them instead of cheer them on? The most powerful thing about antiheroes is, in my opinion, that they make you ask, where is that line for you? Well, certainly feels good to cover that topic. This is a video we've been waiting to make for years, and next week's video is also something I've been waiting to make for quite a long time. It's about magic systems and what magic really means to us as storytellers. It's one of my favorite videos we've made in a while. Unfortunately, it's still going to be another whole week before you get to see it. Although, you could go watch it right now if you wanted to. It's already online, waiting to be watched ad-free over on our streaming platform, Nebula. Actually, we've got a bunch of stuff over there that you won't ever be able to see here on YouTube. Full videos like this one about a fantasy world that basically has its own gigantic geographic genitalia, or this one about the morphology of angels and why artists are always giving them wings, even though they didn't really have them in the source material. You can find all our videos there a week earlier than they upload on YouTube, plus all of these exclusive videos we only upload to Nebula. We even have an entire original series called Worldsmiths over there that we are just so proud of. And we are not the only ones who have been posting there. The same is true for so many other amazing creators. YouTube is kind of a crazy place to make content. Don't get me wrong, I'm happy to have this platform, but you have to be so, so careful about your topic choices, your packaging, what you include in your videos. You just start to feel like you're walking on eggshells. Nebula doesn't have any of those concerns. It's an entirely different environment, devoid of the weird YouTube cynicism. The entire platform was built by creators for creators. Every time you watch a video there, a creator you love is getting paid, and far more than they would ever get paid on YouTube. And on top of all of that, Nebula even helps its creators to fund incredible original content that they never would have been able to make on their own. You know, like our series, Worldsmiths. And here's the really fun part, you can get Nebula for cheaper than almost any other streaming platform on the internet, like $2.50 a month. That cheap. We want you to have access to our Nebula content, so we've managed to get Tale Foundry fans who sign up using our link a whole 40% off the usual rate. Oh, and I didn't even mention, did I? Nebula is more than just a video streaming platform. It also offers classes created by creators, which peel back the curtain to show you what it means to make your own content. If you've ever been curious what it's like to do what we do, this is the best way to find out, and maybe even get started yourself. So, here's how to see next week's video right now, get access to all our exclusive content, all of Nebula, and all of those amazing creator classes. All you have to do is click the link in the description or go to go.nebula.tv/tailfoundry and sign up for 1 year. That's it. And with our discount, that first year is only going to be $30, which again comes out to just $2.50 per month. Frankly, I'm not quite sure how they can afford to do this for us, but I'm definitely not complaining. Seriously, take advantage of this offer while it's still going. I don't think any better one exists in the world of streaming. Anyway, that's all for this one. Thanks for watching, and keep making stuff up. I'll see you next week. Bye!